I can't officially start until Julie gets back, my niece, but I just thought of something earlier today. We were talking about the Schlays, and maybe all of you are well aware of how the mine operated up here and so forth, but the Schlays were occupied primarily by the management people. The Schley 1 was the mine manager. And, all the way around, I think Schley 14 belonged to the fire chief of the that was up here at the time, and so the various management people had the various chalets. And several years before I retired in 83, there was a student from Washington State University that was doing a study. She was in anthropology, and she was doing the socioanthropology, I think it was called. And she came up here, and she actually grew up here as a child. Her father was working in the mine. And so she was very interested in Holden, so she did a study of the Schleys, and at least according to her, I never saw the final report, but she said that the Schleys were designed so that they indicated the status of the person, so that Schley number 1 was the largest and was the most elaborate of the Schleys, and as you went up the hill, they got less and less elaborate. Like I think 14, where we lived for quite a number of years, didn't have a screened-in back porch. That was one of the status symbols that there were. And also, she even measured kitchen counter, the type of counter and so forth. And it was, it was a marvelous study, and it just indicated that they were very socially or status conscious at that time. And of course, in the lodges were for the single men at the mine, and then Winston Camp, which was up the road that was burned down, I think, in 1964, that was for the married miners. And they actually owned their own homes. And when the mine closed down, they had an option to take them out with them. And the mine, as I understand it, even offered to barge them down lake at no cost if they would, you know, take the house apart. And a few people did. A lot of people just took, window frames and sinks and some things out and took them down to rebuild their homes and so forth. But the mine did a lot of work. But the other thing was, somebody was talking about liquor in the village. And this used to be, or Lodge 5 was one of the regular lodges, just like 1, 2, 3, and 4. But before Holden Village started, before I came up here, this, for some reason, the salvage company that was working up in the mine started taking this lodge apart so that they had all the wallboard off, all the plumbing out of it and so forth. And but the first two rooms, which were right over here, just the same size as in the lodges, that was the liquor store. And the mine had a rule that if you wanted liquor, you could bring it up yourself, but you had to order it from the mine. So you'd come to, they had a window, where that window is, there was a pass-through window from the porch. And you could, just like a liquor store. You didn't go into the liquor store, but you could order what you wanted, and then, a couple of days later, it would come up on the boat, and you could come and pick it up. And they had a very strict rule about inebriation, drunkenness on the street. If they ever found you with any signs of drunkenness, it was automatic dismissal. At least that's what I was told. And they would not, there weren't any questions. It was just automatic. They would fire you and send you down the lake. And so it was, they had a pretty strict, but also I understand that, Ernie Gibson was the pilot for Chelan Airways for many years on Lake Chelan. And he would make special runs up lake with his seaplane. He would get, I think they could even make phone calls, but he would get notices that so-and-so wanted some liquor, and they would meet him down at the dock at Lucerne. He would fly it up lake, so that was pretty expensive liquor, but I guess if you were interested in it, that's how you got it. So, but anyway, we'll get started with sort of session 2, which I think is listed as program. And I'm not, when I was up here, I wasn't involved with the program. I was manager, general manager, and was involved in all the facilities, staffing, and so forth. And Carol Hinderly was the was the program person. And so, I mean, we had a very, I mean, I wasn't involved in program, he wasn't involved with facilities, not because we had any great agreement, he just didn't like facilities and I didn't have any ability in program, so there was no question about how that would work out. But when Holden started up here, there was really no planned program that the board had put together. They didn't have a committee saying this is what we're going to do at Holden once it starts, because they, really didn't have any plans. And Holden happened rather quickly that it came into being, and they had some, the board was set up after the nonprofit corporation was set up in the state of Washington. And of course, then the board, I think, started thinking about, programming, and Wilton Bergstrand was the first director that they, or he was the first person they offered the directorship to, and then since he didn't take it, then Carol Henderly was offered the position, and Carol had been the youth director in the old ELC for a number of years, and because of a merger, he was without a job, so it worked out well for Carol to come up here and be director. And some of them, at that point, there was nothing to compare Holden to except the Bible camps. And there were Bible camps all around the country. And I'm sure that some of you and many people attended Bible camps as young people. I think most of the Bible camps were up till high school. I can't remember, but it wasn't post-high school. So it was it was a different type of camping understanding or program that they had set up for Bible camps, and it was wonderful. It involved a lot of kids, and it was sort of the spiritual summer camp that the rich kids in the East went to, camps that nobody else could afford. Well, the Bible camps offered Bible study and religious songs and canoeing if you were on a lake. So it was a wonderful opportunity for many youth in the church. But so naturally, people were starting to talk about Holden in terms of, is this just going to be an adult Bible camp? Because adults love Bible camps, but there was nothing for them to do, so maybe Holden could come to the adult Bible camp. And that was natural that they would, talk in terms of that, but that really didn't fit what Carol Henderly had in mind. He had... Carol was very much a theologian, and he had been to Europe, and I don't know if it was when he was youth director, but he had been to Europe and attended some of the camps there that were set up after the war, the World War II war. And they set up camps. I think it was the Lutheran and the Christian churches in Europe that set these camps up, and. Then it allowed adults to come together to study, to be together in community, after this terrible war had occurred. And so some of his ideas of what Holden should be was really based on his experience in Europe. The one thing I remember is that he said that the one thing we have to be really careful of is because what ruined the European work camps was single women, that he said that apparently there were a lot of single older women in Europe that were part of the church and were looking for a community to belong to, and so they came to these camps, and I never got a clarification why he said that they ruined the camping experience over there, but he says that I can remember, because we had, at that time we were starting to get some retired people on staff, as it is now, but in those days it was brand new, and probably a higher percentage of them were single women that had lost spouse and so forth, and so this was a natural place, and we needed people, and it was a wonderful experience. But I can still remember that he was just a little bit leery that that we've got to be careful not to have too many single women at Holden, and of course that never happened, and that was really part of the program too, that the volunteers, we didn't have any choice but to make use of volunteers. The Forerunners, I think you heard them mentioned, they were the first volunteer work camp to come up here, and actually under the directorship of Wilton Bergstrand, and they were the first ones to start cleaning up Holden after the gift was given. And I remember them saying that there were 9,000 window panes that needed replacement because they'd been broken out. Sometimes when there was nobody here after the mine, that people would come through here and they would, there wasn't major destruction, but there was some destruction. And window panes is one of them. And but they had a wonderful time, and it was really the start of, I guess what you'd say, is a volunteer program. So we can thank the forerunners for beginning that, because they proved that, you know, young adults wanted to come here, and they were young adults, post 18-year-olds, and up to maybe 35. And so that really is how that got started. And I mentioned this morning that the three Lutheran youth bodies at that time were involved initially in the program, or trying to get the program going. And they were the first ones to set up a volunteer selection. And so like the Missouri Synod, the ELC, and the ALC, or the, I guess it was LC, I can't remember anyway, the three major ones, whichever ones they were. They were each supposed to come up with 30 volunteers per month for June, July, and August. So they had the responsibility, and then I think the intent was that they would send one person from their staff or somebody they would select to also come up here, you know, to be with that group of 30. Well, it turned out for whatever reason that especially the Missouri Synod and the LCA didn't really follow through with finding 30, so we ended up with a real short staff. The ALC or the whatever, ALC, they did follow through. They got their 30, but after that first year, both Carol and I, you know, decided, well, this isn't going to work, so we'll just take it over ourselves. And so that started the process of Holden advertising and promoting a volunteer work program, and also making the selection. And since it didn't, that wasn't considered program, then that fell under my jurisdiction. And so that, in a sense, I was the volunteer coordinator, and along with the other things. And I continued to do that. Out of the 20 years I was here, the 18 of those years I was also the volunteer coordinator, and, you know, worked with all of all volunteers as far as setting up, you know, work programs and so forth. And it worked very well. But the thing was, in those days, and it's not true today, is that volunteerism is entirely different than it is now. I mean, I can remember that we involved like 100 volunteers over the summer. And we might get 300 to 400 applications to fill those 100 spots. So, you know, most of my work was telling people they couldn't come and putting them on a waiting list, because they said, you know, we want to be on a waiting list. If we can't come up right away, put us on a waiting list in case somebody cancels out. And so it was an entirely different experience at that point of having, you know, so many people volunteer for the program. And then the other thing we discovered, and it was not by plan, but really by just sort of accident, is that we would get retired people come up here, and they would come up here as paying guests, but they'd say, can we work? And, you know, we said, well, you're a paying guest. That's okay. We don't care. We just want to work with the work here. And so it became evident that there were retired people out there. I think what happened, and this was in, you know, like in 1963, 64, 65, you know, and that was about the time that pensions were starting to be a real thing within society. I mean, people were actually retiring from professional life and having a retirement to live on. And so all of a sudden you had these great retired people that had energy and they had ability, looking for something to do in society. And Holden, for many of them, accomplished that. And it was, again, it wasn't by plan. It was just, it just happened. And so we discovered that not only were the youth from 18 to 25 or 35 wanting to come up here, but it was also the retired people. And then what we discovered, again, just by observation, was that the volunteers, the retired people and the younger people, the 18 to 35, they put together a type of a community that I don't think we could have tried to design. But what happened is that the retired people became the surrogate grandparents for some of these younger people that maybe didn't have a grandparent, or they didn't get along with their parents, or didn't get along with their grandparents. And so we had this marvelous sort of symbiotic relationship that was developing between the retired people and the young people in the community. And, you know, so that, again, it wasn't a matter that that's what we planned, but that's what the, that's what happened, just sort of by natural happenstance. And of course, once we observed it, then we started promoting it. And, you know, retired people would go back to their home congregations saying they had this wonderful experience. So all of a sudden, we started getting a lot of applications from retired people. And the same way with the young people, the 18 to 35-year-olds, they would go back to their colleges and tell others that, you know, they had this experience up here, and you could hike in the mountains, you could, you know, be in a mountain community, and pretty soon we had, you know, all of these volunteers that were wanting to come up here, begging to come up here. And so it was, in those years, it was very easy. And things have changed. Even by 1983, when I retired from here, it was becoming more and more difficult to find volunteers to fill all the spaces. And I think even now, partially because of remediation, but at least from the little that I understand, that it's been hard to fill all the volunteer needs, at least for this year. Now, next year, again, it might be easier, and maybe after that, but society has changed, even financially in society. You know, in those years, most of the parents could still afford to send their kids to college, and, you know, they could get out of college without debt. Now, you know, you hear these stories of people going to school and ending up with $100,000 debt. Well, they can't come up to Holden Village and volunteer their time, you know, if they're $100,000 in debt. So, again, Holden, it was fortunate that Holden came into being, you know, at a unique time in society that, you know, allowed volunteers to come up here. And it was also a time when it was a unique time in society when a lot of lay people in the church were starting to ask serious questions of their pastors, and they wanted to read theology, and the pastors were sort of saying, no, you know, we're the ones that read theology, you listen to us and we'll explain it to you. I mean, I'm exaggerating it, obviously, but and we actually had some pastors that were unhappy with Holden in those early years, and they said, you know, you're causing problems for us in the congregation because people are coming back from Holden and they've sat at the feet of scholars that we only have read by books. You know, we never had a chance to be with them in person at the snack bar or on a hike and discuss theology or discuss science or discuss any of these things. So things were starting to change in the church at that point, and Holden, you know, again, it wasn't by design, but it just happened to be the right time in society. And I think that that's what helped Holden to develop in those years, is that these, a lot of people were, I mean, some examples were like Fritz Norstedt, who probably many of you know, he's no longer living. He was a professor at Lutheran Theological Seminary, or whatever it's called, in St. Paul. And he was also a good friend of Carol's. So, you know, he would come up here. Well, he would be lecturing someplace in the country during the wintertime, which happened down in Richland, Washington, and Leo Bustad happened to be in the audience when Fritz Norstedt was lecturing. And, you know, Leo said to Fritz, you know, I've got to hear more from you. Leo Bustad was at that point, he was involved in the Hanford research. He was a PhD in biology and PhD in, I think, physiology. And he was working on a miniaturized pig that could be used for, I think, primarily dermatology studies at Hanford with atomic energy, you know, because the pig skin, at least as I understand it, is very similar to the human skin. In fact, a lot of the pig biology is similar to the humans, which should say something about us, but either the pig or us, one or the other. Anyway, Leo said, you know, I've got to hear more from Fritz. And he went to Fritz and said, well, you know, where are you going to talk next? And Fritz said, well, I'm going up to Holden Village. Leo had never heard of Holden Village. Well, Leo was introduced to Holden Village, and pretty soon he became a regular lecturer up here. And he was one that helped form the Science and Technology Committee. And another friend of his, Bill Matheson, who I think now lives, I'm not sure if he's still living, I think he is over in Bainbridge Island, no, in San Juan Islands. And he was with the Donald Douglas Research Labs in Hanford. And he was the one that said that, you know, I don't have time to come appear in the volunteer staff, but I would love to be able to, you know, answer questions or make, you know, advise you on certain things if it was. And, you know, I talked to him about, you know, well, how about setting up a committee? he said, great idea. I'd love to be a part of that committee. So that's really what started the Science and Technology Committee. And Leo and Bill Matheson and Rudy Edmond and many others. In fact, Joel is on the Science Committee now, and Wayne is here, and yeah. And he was, oh yeah, there, oh yeah, there. Yeah, and Larry Howard, and I don't know, maybe some others, but that's how the Science and Technology Committee got started. And it was just, you know, people like that wanted to contribute something to Holden, but it was all part of the program. And I better check my notes here so I don't get too far out of line. But some of these things, again, were not on the basis of somebody planning them out, but they just happened by, you know, people asking, can we help up here? And this is the way it happened. Vern Rieke, who many of you at least have heard of, he's no longer living either. And he was the chairman of the board of Holden for many years. He was a professor at the law school at University of Washington, very much involved in the Lutheran Church really around the world. And he was on the Lutheran World Federation board, I think. Anyway, I know he was involved in it. And he was involved in the Lutheran Church throughout the United States. And the very fact that he was willing to associate himself with Holden Village in those beginning years, he helped set up the corporation, the nonprofit corporation, gave Holden Village, in a sense, an entrance into the world scene, because here Vern Rieke was traveling around the world and would talk to people and in conversation would, you know, say, you know, I'm working with Holden Village and you might pay attention to it, you know, or you might consider coming to be on faculty. And so he was one of the great people in the state and the nation and the world that really helped Holden Village gain some stature, in a sense, because nobody had heard about Holden Village, and there was no reason for anybody to want to come this far, you know, to go to some place that they didn't know anything about. But when people like Fritz Norstedt and Vern Rieke and Leo Bustedt and some of the others were associated with it, people started saying, well, maybe we'll pay some attention to it. And fortunately, and this was, I mean, the board was very fortunate to pick Carol Henderly as the director, because Carol had a lot of contacts. His father-in-law was a bishop of the old Norwegian Lutheran Church, so right away he had contacts into that aspect of it. But he also became friends with people like Fritz Norstedt and other people who not only were good program people, but also in some of the congregations that Carol was involved with, that people had some money. So a lot of the fundraising in those early years was Carol going to his friends and saying, hey, you know, you owe me. And they responded, and they helped Holden get started. And but another one that Carol was close friends with was Howard Hong. I don't know if some of you probably recognize. He was at St. Olaf College for many years and was a Kierkegaard scholar. Both he and his wife translated Kierkegaard from the original Danish. I think they did the original translation, as far as I know. But marvelous scholars and also good friends of Carol. So, you know, Carol went to Howard and said, you know, come out to Holden. You know, it'll be fun. Because they had worked at a truck garden together in college. And, you know, so they were good buddies. And Howard said, I'll come out there if there's a sauna there. And because Howard was, I mean, saunas to him were were part of the spiritual existence of life. And so Carol, of course, said, oh yeah, we've got a sauna. Well, we didn't have a sauna, but Carol came to me and said, you know, Howard's coming in 3 weeks, and I promised him a sauna. And so we sort of looked around, where the sauna is now, they call it the city sauna. That was the garbage shed for the mine. And it was a concrete building that where they stored the garbage during the mine so it wouldn't freeze. And they even had a little stove in there I think the smokestack is still there. And they would heat it enough so that the garbage wouldn't freeze during the wintertime so they could haul it out. And anyway, that building was there. And so we said, well, let's make this our sauna. It's already got a stove in it. So when Howard arrived, we had a sauna, and it's been improved over the years, and it's now, I think somebody said it was electric. Is that right? I don't know. That was the original sauna, and Howard Hong had his sauna, and of course, then when he came, he became known as Sauna Claus, because he would make deep fried wheat, which was salted, and he took, I think it was soft wheat, and we were able to get some soft wheat from a rancher down in Waterville and bring it up here for Howard, and he would, before the evening saunas, he would go into the kitchen and he'd put, you know, hot oil in the pan, and then he would deep fry wheat, and then he would salt it, and that's what, you know, people would eat in the sauna to keep their salt system in their system as they sweated, and that was, I mean, it was a ritual that became almost spiritual for for the village and sort of has continued on, but it was all because Carol wanted Howard to be on faculty, and the only way Howard would come on faculty was if he had a sauna. So those are, again, you know, some of the unique things that happened in this place that weren't necessarily planned, but were very much a part of the operation, and even the beginning of the tape ministry was sort of by happen chance that actually I picked up a reel-to-reel recorder at a pawn shop because Holden didn't have any recording equipment at that time, and I think I paid $15 or something for a reel-to-reel reel-to-reel recorder, and I was personally interested in recording them because I never was able to get to many of the sessions because I was working. And so I thought if we could record them, then other staff members could listen to them too. So we started recording. I would just run down to, you know, wherever the lecture was and start it. And then sometimes forget it. And 2 hours later, we'd go down there and get the tape. And then we started saving those as an opportunity for other staff members. And then one thing led to the other, and then the tape ministry became a very important part of, you know, the Holden ministry, which now is streaming to the world, and it's wonderful. Jeff, my son, he flies for Verizon and out of Spokane, so he drives from Leavenworth to Spokane on a regular basis, and oftentimes he's listening to Holden recordings that he's taken off the streaming and put on his little iPad or iPod or whatever pod or I it is, one of those. But this is again how Holden has made a tremendous difference in the world and, you know, opened up, the learning and the excitement of what happens here to the world. And I can remember one time that Vern Rieke, in fact, it was in the early days, and Carol had invited Vern Rieke up to be on faculty, which was a very special thing because Vern was in demand all over the place and was paid big bucks to, you know, give a lecture or give a talk, and so Vern agreed to come up here, and again he was chairman of the board. And at that time, a lot of our lectures were down in what now is Narnia, the old schoolhouse we called it. And so that we didn't have Koinonia at that time for lectures, but that was available, and there were two or three rooms down there that could be used for lecture space. And I remember that Carol came to me and said, Vern Rieke's coming up, And he's giving a lecture at a certain time, and I want you to quietly circulate the word around to all the staff that they need to show up for Burns' lecture at 11 o'clock down in Narnia, in the schoolhouse, because we didn't have many paying guests at that time, and Carol didn't want Vern to be speaking to an empty group, so we filled the place with, we just shut down the village and had everybody attend Vern Rieke's lecture. And it was great, and Carol would always chide the staff, because sometimes a little bit later on when there were more lectures going on, a lot of the staff wouldn't show up for anything. And it really hurt Carol, and because for Carol, since the volunteer staff were volunteering and there was no remuneration at all, Carol thought that the program we offered here was their payment, and he was always upset that they weren't taking advantage of their payment. And you know, when we had staff meetings, he would say, you know, you're missing out on your pay. You've got to come to these tremendous lectures that we have. And, you know, and sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But, I mean, there was also a work, you know, program going on. And so it wasn't always easy for the volunteers to attend some of these lectures. And this is, again, where the tape ministry started coming in, is that it allowed some of the, you know, the staff then to attend some of the lectures through that way. The first faculty that was up here in 1963 was Carol Henderly and Ewald Bash, who was in the old ALC and was a poet and an author, and Rudy Edmond, who was the geologist that many of you probably heard in past years when you were up here. And Rudy and Doris and Beanie and Gertrude really came up here through Wilton Bergstrand. Wilton was the youth director of the ELCA, and he knew these people from, because Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois was an Augustana college. And so he was really the one that got Beanie and Gertrude and Rudy and Doris involved up here. And then also Armin Graham, who I think he was a sociologist, and he also did some electrical work for us. I don't think he was certified, but I think he did some electrical work for us. And then, of course, Beanie Lundholm was the dear musician that Holden had for many, many years. And of course, Fritz Norstad was one of the first ones. And then also Gene Swihart, who I don't know if many of you know either Gene or Al, but Gene was one of these very interesting, eclectic, hard to understand persons that had a very interesting. Her father was a very, I think, a famous attorney in Oklahoma, and dealt a lot with oil legal aspects of drilling for oil and so forth. And so she grew up in a very wealthy home, and but her mother died and her father remarried, and when, at least this is what Jean told me, and I never quite knew if I could understand or if I could believe everything that Jean said, but most of it I think was true. And anyway, when her mother died and her father remarried, then she lost her inheritance, and so she was basically on her own. And but she had, she had been climbing guide in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, and she trained horses and, you know, all kinds of things. And again, I mean, she did so much, and it was so interesting that I just accepted everything she said because I didn't care, because she was an interesting person. And anyway, she was one of that was on the staff too. And Doris Edmond and Gene Swihart were the ones that started the children's program up here. It became evident fairly early on that if the adults that were coming here, and that's primarily what Holden was interested in, were the parents, but if they brought their kids, we needed to do something with the kids so that the parents could attend, you know, the lectures. And so we started, you know, at that time it was just called the children's program, now it's called Narnia. And but Doris Edmond, again, it was just by luck that she was known throughout the United States for starting her preschool program at Augustana. I think it was associated with Augustana in Rock Island. It was called the Red Shoes, Little Red, I think Little Red Shoes or Red Shoes. And Gene Swigert was a good friend of Doris, so they worked together to set this children's program up, and it was marvelous. And they, once they got it set up, then it was really turned over to some of the volunteer staff, and that was included in the volunteer staff program then with Doris Edmond and Gene Swigert always available to sort of help them out and teach them. So, and then of course Narnia turned out to be a great program for the children, and our kids that grew up here, Jeff, who is up here now, he was in the third grade, or he was entering the fourth grade when we moved down to Leavenworth, and Christy, our daughter, was going into the eighth grade. And they generally didn't go to all the Narnia naturally, because it, I mean, day after day, year after year. But anytime there was a celebration where there was ice cream or anything like that, they always attended those and always had the option of attending. But it was a wonderful program, and one that was made it possible again for, you know, the parents then to come to the lectures, and there was a lot of the faculty over the early years came back year after year. People like the Edmonds and the Lundholms, Fritz Norstedt didn't come back every year, but Paul and Julie Hain, he was an economist and also he was an ordained pastor. Many of those people came back year after year, really by design. I mean, I think it was Carol's intent that would happen. And at one point then, I think when John and Murray Schramm came as directors, there were some people that were starting to get worried that there was a clique of faculty and that it was not good for Holden to have this core faculty here year after year after year. I mean, my personal feelings, again, I wasn't involved in the program, but I think that core faculty brought something very special to Holden, because we had people that, you know, knew the Edmonds, they knew the Lundholms, they knew Fritz Norstedt, they knew Carol and Mary Hinderle, they knew all of these people. And so, in a sense, when they were here in the summertime, they would come back here, and it was like, in a sense, coming back to a family reunion, where they knew these people, they valued them very highly for their intellectual abilities. And so I think that, I don't disagree that maybe the change should have been made, but I think it was a loss of the Holden community, in a sense. And but the Holden, again, I mentioned before, that was right in society at a special time, and the church was going through a lot of things right at that time too, which increased Holden's, I think, value to the church and society, because right about that time the Missouri Synod was going through, you know, a lot of controversy, and Seminex, you know, Seminary in Exile, I guess it was called Seminex, and they broke away from the Lutheran Seminary in St. Louis, and there were people like Paul Hain was involved in that. Rich Kamer's father was involved in that, so Rich Kamer, in a sense, was sort of involved in that. Norm Hobble, who was another one that some of you may or may not have heard of, he came up because he was he was kicked out of the old Missouri Synod church, and then went on to Seminex. But I remember the first time he came up here, he was from Australia, and he had come over here. He was ordained originally in Australia, so he had his ordination already here. But he came over and he taught at the Lutheran Seminary in St. Louis, and he was also a playwright, and he would write these very interesting liberal plays, which didn't go over very well in the Missouri Synod. And one of them that I remember that had a good run up here, all of those plays had a good run up here, they were loved, was Adam and Eve and the Elephant, it was called. And the whole play was based on Adam and Eve, of course, hiding from God, and they hid in a hole, and of course then the elephant sat on the hole, And, you know, I mean, I can't remember all the details of it, but I remember that part. And anyway, I think that was the play that finally got Norm Hobble kicked out of the seminary. And just in the last year, I've had reconnection with Norm Hobble in Australia. He's totally retired, but and of course he has very fond memories of Holden Village and loved his experience here and so forth. But Holden became the sort of the safe haven for many of these professors that not only from the Missouri Synod, but even in some of the other Lutheran colleges that, you know, maybe we're thinking outside the box and weren't quite accepted in the church anymore. And Holden became a safe haven for that, not only a safe haven, but then an opportunity for many people to get acquainted with these tremendous theologians and people. And I mean, I think it helped them too. Well, even like Liz and Rich Kamer, who some of you know, he was the head of the art department Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And they started coming here partially in that same context of this problem within the Missouri Synod, because Rich, you know, was a prolific artist, and he wanted to create art in a religious sort of setting or community, and he just couldn't do that at Valparaiso. He said it just didn't seem to work, and he came out here one summer and you know, just had a great time. And then they spent at least one, maybe two winters here. I know at least one winter, he brought the whole family here and they spent the whole winter here. And he did a lot of artwork as well as, you know, lecturing and doing some things. And it was here at Holden that he got the idea for the Grunewald Guild, which now exists in North Leavenworth in Plain, Washington. And because what he wanted to do, he said that one winter when he was here, that he was so productive in terms of his art, and he was convinced it was because of the community that existed here at Holden. And he went back to Valparaiso that next year, and he tried to duplicate that at Valparaiso, and he said he couldn't do it, so he just gave up. He quit his job at Valparaiso. They came out to Plain. They found the Grange Hall, which had been up for sale and nobody wanted to buy. And so he and Liz bought it and started the Grunewald Guild, which now is, I think, almost 30 years old. So it's almost not quite as old as Holden, but it really had its beginnings at Holden because Holden became a safe haven for Rich Tamer in his art, that he was having problems, you know, in duplicating in Valparaiso and so forth. So it's again another example of how Holden has you know, been involved in the church and in the world. In fact, it's interesting that at one point, and that there was an effort by the board to try to duplicate Holden. They thought that if Holden was so successful here and had such an impact with so many people, you know, maybe we should try to duplicate it. And so that they did spend a lot of time trying to come up with a way to duplicate the Holden program. And one of the earliest ones, which happened before the board sort of got involved in it, Holden was contacted by one of the Lutheran camping groups in Hawaii, in Oahu. That's where Waikiki is, isn't it, Oahu?
Yeah.
And they wrote a letter to Carol and said, you know, since Holden is closed in the wintertime, at that point Holden hadn't opened in the wintertime, they said, well, why don't you bring your staff over to Hawaii and operate our, I don't remember the name of the camp, but it was a big camp that they had on Oahu. They said, pardon?
Makapala.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah. And so that, and I remember, you know, Carol coming in to me with his letter and said, we're going to Hawaii. Because he had been over there on preaching engagements, and he loved Hawaii. You know, and then we did give it some consideration. I think at the next board meeting, you know, we brought it up with sort of a proposal, but at that time we were just starting to think in terms of opening the village in the wintertime. So it didn't work out, but it was a fun concept and a fun idea to think of, that at that point, we might have moved over to Hawaii for the our winter and then moved back here for the summer. But probably that wouldn't have worked, so unfortunately it didn't go. But it brought, right about that time, in fact, in 1966, that's when the Holden decided to try keeping the village open in the wintertime. And up to that point, it had always been closed down. We moved the office to Seattle. At first it was in the Berg Fuel office in Ballard, and then we rented a space from Gethsemane Lutheran Church in downtown Seattle. They had a parking lot with a little building in it that was rented out to a couple different nonprofits, and Holden rented one of the offices there for, I think, one winter or two winters. And then we opened Holden in the year around. But it was decided to give it a try one year, and there were five of us that lived up here at Holden. The hydroelectric plant had been completed in August of 1964, so there was electricity up here. And with just, we were in Chalet 1, all five of us lived in Chalet 1, and we had no idea, you know, how it was going to work out, and didn't have any experience with it. So, you know, we figured we had to have food for the entire winter up here, including eggs and everything, and so we had freezers, and we had eggs. I remember that in April, you really couldn't fry them anymore. I mean, they were still safe to eat, but the yolks didn't work anymore, or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they were edible. But you know, we didn't realize we could have sent a note down on the boat and got fresh vegetables up here weekly, but we just, I guess, didn't explore it or didn't realize, and because other people along the lake were doing that, but you know, we didn't have any fresh vegetables. And if somebody went out for something, or if we had one of our friends came to visit us, we told him, you know, bring a head of lettuce, please bring a head of lettuce. and so we had a great winter, but it was definitely a learning experience, and that was the first time that Holden had a snow vehicle. It was a Swedish snowcat. It was called Snow Track, and it was powered by the VW engine. And I don't know if one of the bodies may still be up there. Maybe they pulled them out. I'm not sure. But they were good little snowmobiles. They held six people inside a sort of a semi-heated cab, and that was our transportation back and forth. And it wasn't ideal, but it worked, and we actually got a second one. And then later on, when more and more people started coming up here, then we got the Bombardier. I can't remember anyway. The Bombardier vehicles that had a track on the back and skis on the front. And in Canada, they were made by Bombardier, who now call, since they're into airplanes, they call them Bombardier. That sounds better than Bombardier. Because Bombardier used to be a logging equipment manufacturer. And then they got into these snowmobiles just because, out of necessity, Canada needed some taxis. And they came up with this 12-passenger snow vehicle. And then they got into airplanes. And I think they're still making the snow vehicles. The Bombardier used to make the... it was the single track, you know, like the recreational snowmobiles that they have now. At that time, in fact, Bill Peel from Mount Vernon, he was on the board, and he and his wife gave me $1,000, or said, they gave Holden $1,000 and said, you know, we need a snow vehicle for Reuben because he's been snowshoeing down to get his mail once a month, and we need to provide some transportation. And so they said, here's $1,000, see if you can find a snow vehicle. At that time in Seattle, there were only two businesses that sold any snowmobiles. I mean, if you can compare that now to, you know, the hundreds of businesses that sell snowmobiles. But at that time, Bombardier and one other company that was, I think, out of Minnesota were the only ones that sold snowmobiles. And we got the Bombardier and had it, we brought it up here. Bill and his wife and I hauled it up on the boat and drove it up here and gave it to Reuben, and he used it for the time that he was up here. But that was again how the winter got started up here. And then once it got started and a few people started coming, then, you know, more and more people found out about it, and the demand grew. And so we moved, the next year I think we opened up Chalet 2, and then finally in, I think it was 1969, we opened up Koinonia. By that time, Koinonia was built, not quite like it is now, but it didn't have the addition over here. It was just this part, and there was a little kitchen, sort of where the, right out in the entryway here. So all of our meals were eaten in here. We had folding tables, and for the, I mean, at one point, I think we had about 70 people that were here in the wintertime, and so every meal we would put up folding tables and, you know, fix the meals in this little kitchen here, and it worked well, and it was, again, the start of how the program developed in the wintertime. And the, you know, one thing led to the other. As we opened up, then there were more professors from our various universities that came up on sabbaticals. And at that point, I think they still do, but what was it, every 7 years that the professor could get a year sabbatical. And so they would bring their families up here. The first year they came, we didn't have a school, and they basically were just homeschooling. But almost immediately, just again by chance, there was a judge from Whitman County in eastern Washington, and that he came up here one summer with his family, and after he was here a few days, he came up to us and said, you know, have you ever thought about having a group home up here? He said that most of his work as a judge was dealing with parents and with children, that children were taken away from their parents, and it was part of his obligation or responsibility to find facilities that would take these boys. And most of the facilities were, you know, 20 or 30 boys, and he said it just isn't working. I mean, these boys aren't gaining what they need to out of an experience like this, and we can't find any organization that'll have a small group home because it's not a financially feasible. He said, would you consider having a group home up here? And so, you know, in a sense, it wasn't going to cost us anything because we were already in operation. So, you know, Carol and I said, sure, we'll give it a try. So we then became a group home in the state of Washington. We had six boys that were 14 to 17 years of age. And it turned out to be a marvelous experience. And again, what it led to was the beginning of the public school up here, because we hadn't had a public school, but the state said, if you're going to have a group home here, you have to have an accredited public school here. So I went down to Chelan, and Cecil West was the superintendent in Chelan at that time. He was a member of the Lutheran Church, which helped, and he was somewhat familiar with Holden, and I said, you know, if you'll give us credit, if you'll give us accreditation to the school up here, we'll supply the teachers free of charge. Because we already had a teacher that had been on our volunteer staff. Bev Cagle was her name. She still lives in Leavenworth. At that, I can't see Cagle as her married name, Bev Schultz. Bev Schultz was from Wisconsin. She'd been on the volunteer staff, and she heard that we were thinking about having a public school, and she said, well, I'll stay here. I'll volunteer my time to be the public school teacher. And I told Cecil West that, he said, sounds good to me, you know, and so he guaranteed that they would give accreditation to the school. So Bev Schultz was our teacher, and she spent the first winter up here in a teaching school. And in fact, the first graduate of high school up here was that year with Bev Schultz. And there's one, well, he's middle-aged now, but still living in Wenatchee, that I've had some contact with. Jim Allen is his name, a wonderful young kid. Well, not young anymore, but he was really a genius, but he had had some problems in the family, and the courts took him away from his family, and one of the options was to go to Holden Village, and so, you know, here he was, and, you know, he didn't know anything about Holden Village. None of these six boys that came up here did. And but Jim was, I think, one of the unique ones that now in Wenatchee, he's sort of listed as the one person who fights for peace and justice more than anybody else in the whole area. And he, because of his intelligence, he came up with a device, a testing device, that has something to do with the fruit industry. I think it tests sugar in the apples or something. Anyway, he invented this thing. And I'm not sure, but I think he, and then he even manufactured it, because it wasn't a, you know, not a lot of people needed these, but it was for testing. And so that was, he repaired TVs and stereos and so forth when that was still possible, and then he had this testing device. And the rest of the time he was spending writing letters and sending letters to the editor and meeting with people and trying to promote peace and justice in the world. And so it was a great example of, you know, what can happen. Another one of the young boys that I haven't had any contact with, he was also into electronics, and he maintained the NPR transmitters for Wenatchee and Chelan for many years, you know, up on the mountains. And I think he's still around, but I just haven't had any contact with him. But that again started because the judge from Whitman County, you know, came over and made this request, and then the group home allowed the school to start, and which now allows a school, both a high school, grades kindergarten through 12, and even Stehekin doesn't have grades 11 or kindergarten through 12. They only go up through grade 8, but because of the circumstances, we were able to start a school with all 12, including kindergarten, up here. And it's worked very well, and it's allowed many more families to come up here than in the wintertime. So, well, that's sort of, this was sort of on program, and I think I hit a lot of things, maybe missed a few things, but do you have any questions or comments, or do you, any, some of you that have been up here, you know, earlier years, that maybe you want to add something to them? But yeah.
Recently I tumbled to the fact that we had other interactions with the court systems and the legal systems, conscientious objectors up here. They were set up here to do their service work and
right.
Stuff like that. Do you know of any of those?
Well, I mean, during the early years, we had one, Dan Stata was his name, and he had been on the volunteer staff here early on, and he was from West Seattle, First Lutheran in West Seattle, who happened to be Carol Hinderly's cousin's church. But the Statas lived over there. Dan came up here on staff, and then I think he was drafted in the Vietnam era, and he applied for conscientious objector, and anyway, was accepted, and so he was up here for 2 years, and basically did the same thing as he did while he was on volunteer staff, but was able to complete his military obligation in that way, and that's the only one, to my knowledge, that at least during those first 20 years, he was the only one. Maybe there's, I guess, do they still have COs, or I don't know. I don't think so, but it's different. But yeah, Dan Stata, to my knowledge, was the only one that came up here. But he did serve his 2 years as a CO up here. But it was interesting that at the end of the Vietnam conflict, we had some former volunteers come back here, and the community was not nice to them, and it really bothered me. And I didn't really totally understand it, because I'd been isolated up here too. But here we had some volunteers who had been on the volunteer staff come back, and I remember one specifically that just wanted to be in the village, and now I think I understand why, but a lot of the staff were just not nice to him, and I think he finally left and decided that, you know, he couldn't stay here any longer. But I mean, that was the unfortunate, you know, one of the unfortunate things of Holden, and it's, you know, Holden hasn't been pure over the years. There's been mistakes that they've made, the one thing before we quit, that Holden also had to help sort of have Chelan get over the color barrier probably the late 60s, early 70s. And Carol had invited somebody from church headquarters, and I think he was maybe in the youth department, and he was a person of color. And, you know, we just send out the regular information to him and say, you know, stay in Chelan the night before you come up here. Well, he came into Chelan, and he went to Campbell's, and they wouldn't give him a room. because he was a person of color. And that's the first time we'd ever, you know, had that experience. And when he did come up here then, Carol immediately went down the lake and had a come to Jesus meeting with the Campbells, who were basically friends of Holden, because Holden supplied a lot of business for him. They're wonderful people and they have a wonderful operation. And, you know, after that, they were very happy to accept peoples of color. So in a sense that Holden even had a little hand, and that was one thing that Holden didn't get too much involved in those years with the whole, you know, issue with Dr. Martin Luther King and so forth. There were, I mean, I can't think of the man's name. His wife is on the board, or was on.
Al Pitcher
was faculty up here and had been a lieutenant for Martin Luther King. So, I mean, Holden had people here that were a part of it, but Holden itself, and I don't remember thinking back, you know, that we dealt a lot with the civil rights issue up here. I think that we did through these people, but it wasn't a major thing. I mean, we had, you know, certainly prayers and we had services and so forth, but at least as I remember, it didn't become the major thing that it was in society, and I guess I've never quite understood why. Maybe, I don't know, but anyway, that we were involved and Carol helped to integrate Chelan, so that was, I think, the main thing. Anything else that, I guess, the Vespers is at 7, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. You want to let folks know when you're presenting more, so you can
come
back?
Oh, yeah, at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, let's see, what is the... It's out there on the bulletin board, but it'll be on how the community developed at Holden. I think it's interesting to see, and you know, there may be some duplicates, but you know, what was really important for Holden was to develop as a community, and that's what I think impacted the lives of so many people. And now, you know, again, society is begging for community, and we just don't have it. We have division, but not community. So I think Holden has a new opportunity in society to help develop community. So anyway,
thank
so tomorrow you. At 11, and then at 6 I'll have another one, and then Wednesday morning the final one, and that'll be, these are somewhat duplicates of what I've given before, but on Wednesday morning at 11, I want to do one on how Holden has changed over the last 56 years. And So that'll be completely new. Might be some duplicates, but it'll completely new.
Thank you.